as a manufacturer, if you have a feed ingredient that can help reduce the presence of salmonella shedding or E. coli in livestock, my gosh, that's something that farmers and ranchers would like to have, the regulatory authorities would like to have, and consumers would like to have. So why can't we get this regulatory blockage out of the way and let us start doing those kinds of practices that really help everyone?
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
DietForge.ai. AI-powered feed formulation with non-linear ingredient modeling and real-time collaboration. Finally, modern software for modern nutritionists. Kemin invites you to optimize animal feed quality and safety with our portfolio of solutions. Learn more at kemin.com/ag. Evonik, we are sciencing the global food challenge. Don't hire another VA stuck in 2015. Hire a remote AI specialist from Latin who runs AI tools, works in your time zone, and helps your team move faster. Schedule your free strategy call at www.wisevas.io. Zentrix Insights. The right person in the right seat starts with knowing how your team is actually wired. Visit ZentrixInsights.com. Zentrix OS, the business operating system built for teams who are serious about goals, tasks, and measurable results. One platform to run your entire operation. Revenue grew, so did your hours. The owner's box, buy back 20 a week. Stop hiring for problems automation can solve. Start with Elevate Agents.
Welcome to the Feed Science Podcast. I'm Adam Fahrenholz, coming to you from North Carolina State University and the Prestige Department of Poultry Science, the animal feeding and management program here. And on behalf of Wisenetics, thanks for joining us. Thanks for listening on your favorite podcast app or watching on YouTube. We appreciate our audience. And any comments or suggestions you might have, we are all ears. Our guest today is a returning guest. I think we've had her on a handful of times now, Constance Coleman. Constance is the president and CEO of AFIA, the American Feed Industry Association, as well as the president of the Institute for Feed Education and Research. Constance, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you so much for having me back on your program.
Yeah, you bet. So I think as has become kind of the typical process for when we have you join us, we like to talk about what's going on in the world of kind of feed regulations or various legislation that's moving through the Congress and what it will look like for the feed industry. So I know we've got three pieces of legislation that we want to talk about today. One is something we've talked about, I know, before, but it's been making some movement. And the other two are probably going to be a little bit more unfamiliar to our audience. So we'll start with the first one, which is the Feed Act or the Innovative Feed Act. So first, if you would remind everybody what exactly that act is all about.
I will indeed, Adam. The Innovative Feed Act is, which is H.R. 2203 or Senate 1906, is a piece of legislation that would correct a decades-old problem that requires some feed ingredients to go through the FDA approval process inappropriately as a drug. And even though these products are not drugs, they act in the gut of the animal. This has been something that's just a holdover from when science hadn't caught up in the regulatory world with the science that's happening in the feed industry world. And so one of the things we're working with is trying to get this modernized, to have this review process that has been delaying innovation and threatening our global competitiveness to come to up to speed with where science is today. So passing the Innovative Feed Act would enable businesses to expand product access. Farmers and ranchers would be able to access tools that would help with a variety of things such as food safety, animal health, and the environmental issues, and allow access to that here in the United States. The thing that I think frustrates our farmers and ranchers, and certainly our feed industry here in the United States, is their competitors have access to these products around the world, but we don't have access here because it's just too burdensome to go through the drug process.
You already know that the key to a profitable operation is healthy, productive animals. This starts with the quality and safety of your production inputs. Our team of experts at Kemin are driven by curiosity to develop science-backed ingredients and solutions to help you maintain feed and water quality, improve intestinal health, optimize nutrition, and eliminate pathogens. Learn more today by diving in at Kemin.com/ag.
And I should mention to everybody, before we started, I had said that I would say this and then I forgot in my introduction. But for those of you that are listening and not watching, Constance joining us from what looks like a really, really nice morning outside. I'm boringly joining you from the Quality Assurance Lab here at the NC State Feed Mill Education Unit. I wish I was where Constance was. But if you hear birds and whatnot in the background, that is not a figment of your imagination. She's getting to enjoy the fresh air. So, I know we want to talk a little bit about what progress the act has made through Congress, but something I do want to touch on real quick is something that you just mentioned. I think that's important, that it's not only that we might have the additives that haven't been able to make it through the approval process that are sitting on a shelf that we can't use. There are things already on the market in other parts around the world, including places that we typically think of as being more regulatory burden than we have. So it's not, okay, if we pass this act 5-6 years from now, there will be things we can use. It will be, if we pass this act, there are things that could be started marketing in the U.S. the next day.
It's so true, because we've got that would still have to go through a regulatory review, but those products are developed and they are being used. Adam, I always joke that when the European Union regulatory scheme gives their producers access to more tools than ours does, I start to wonder what's happening in the world, right? So that is definitely the example. So these products are already developed. They're out on the market. They would have to go through a review here, but it's not something that suddenly frees up more research to be done, which it does, but it allows us access to the tools that are already in existence. I want to give you a quick example, if I may. As a manufacturer, if you have a feed ingredient that can help reduce the presence of salmonella shedding or E. coli in livestock, my gosh, that's something that farmers and ranchers would like to have, the regulatory authorities would like to have, and consumers would like to have. So why can't we get this regulatory blockage out of the way and let us start doing those kinds of practices that really help everyone?
Yeah, absolutely. And to your point as well, when we look around and there's pluses and minuses of all of our regulatory frameworks, but when we look at the EU or we look at Canada, for example, and we say, wait, we're significantly more restrictive than what they're doing, when they are far more on the preventive side even than we are, though we've made a lot of, you know, movement towards that area in the last, you know, decade or so. It's definitely something that it seems like, well, this is probably common sense then, because they in their regulatory structures, they would very unlikely be willing to accept these things if there was a significant issue, because they're far more cautious than our regulatory structure has been historically.
Yes, it's not a safety issue. I mean, that's not it at all. And requiring these ingredients, rather than going through the drug route, to go through the food additive petition process still requires that they're reviewed appropriately. They still promote safety to the animal and the people who eat the resulting meat, poultry, dairy products, eggs, fish, and that the product does what the label says. So there's still that review. We're not asking for less regulation. We're just simply asking for appropriate modernized regulation. And I think that's an important point for everyone to remember on that, is that it's not, we're not saying we need less regulation. We just need appropriate regulation. So yeah. As far as the progress, Adam, it's been introduced as a bipartisan bill in both the House and the Senate. We're asking for additional sponsors on those bills and urging the House Energy and Commerce Committee to have a hearing on the legislation. We're also, as you know, in Congress right now, individual bills are not easily passed. So we're also advocating for that bill to be attached to another piece of legislation for adoption this legislative session. We've already waited far too long for this, with all the, as you pointed out, dozens of other countries that have access to tools through this.
Absolutely. Well, that's you know, I mean, that's great news on the progress. And generally speaking, not that significant pieces of legislation that we want to see passed are always easy to go through. And I say we, I mean, you know, from the feed and the nutrition and the food animal producing and all of those kind of groups rolled in together. It's not typically, you know, that it's always easy to pass. And certainly there's a lot of rulemaking, all that goes on. But it does seem to me that quite often the things that we do want to see and that we get support are bipartisan in nature, which is certainly, you know, rare in this day and age. But it's kind of one of the benefits of our various industries of, you know, every state has some amount of agriculture in it. Every state has feed millers. Every state has, you know, people growing animals and feeding the animals and then feeding us. And so it is nice to see that it, at least in most cases, while it might take a more time than we'd like to see through, support comes from kind of all over the place because there are enough people that realize the importance of what it is that we do in these industries.
It's a wonderful thing, Adam, that everyone eats and everyone recognizes the importance of having a resilient, healthy food and agricultural sector. You're absolutely right. I think something else that probably contributes to the bipartisan support for this legislation is it's just common sense. You know, there's really nothing controversial about making sure your regulations match the science.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. All right. So moving on then to the next piece of legislation, like I said, the next two may be less familiar to folks. So we'll see what those are all about and talk with them, talk to everybody about those. The first is the Securing American Agriculture Act. So what is that and why is it important to our industry?
Well, this is also in both the House and the Senate. H.R. 1995 and Senate 912 is legislation that would require the U.S. Department of Agriculture to study global supply chain markets for U.S. inputs, including feed ingredients such as vitamins and amino acids, to look at what is our dependency and on sole source supplies of ingredients. And we like to think of this legislation a bit as a proxy for understanding the issue that we cannot have a resilient food and agricultural system if all of our supply comes from one part of the world where, let's face it, in this current environment, tensions can wax and wane very easily. So it does. It's also a piece of legislation that, you know, typically doesn't move on its own. But it is the concepts we're urging to get incorporated into other larger pieces of legislation and other marker bills, you know, as a marker bill. One of the things that's a little bit challenging, I think, for people to grasp is this is a first step. This is a piece of legislation that really asks the federal government to take a look at this, identify where our vulnerabilities are, and begin to take action to make us a more resilient industry. The American Feed Industry Association, with the help of a report that was conducted through the Institute for Feed Education and Research, iFeeder, has already demonstrated that one big area of vulnerability we have is our dependence on China solely for a lot of our critical vitamins and the growing dependence on it for amino acids.
Yeah, so I would encourage anybody that if it's the first time you're hearing about this topic in general, well, hopefully it's not. I'd be surprised anybody listening to it if it is, because you've probably seen, you know, your amino acid and vitamin bills go up and down, or in many cases, not even the bill go up and down, but just be told, no, you can't have that or not have that much of it. This is how much we'll send you. But if it's the first time you've heard about that report's accessible. And you should go find it. You might not want to read the entire thing, depending on how much you, you know, love to read data and whatnot, but just some of the summary and for lack of a better term, abstract type of information in there that describes how unlevel that field is as to where these ingredients are coming from. I think even for people that have been in the industry a long time, it might be pretty surprising to them. And then the report gets into a little bit as well with the data on, you know, what happens when these things are unavailable, right? And what does that do to cost of feed and therefore cost of meat, milk, and eggs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Adam, the report was actually very interesting to us because we sensed that there was a challenge there. In the last 10 years, the concentration of existing global capacity for vitamins has just changed dramatically. So you're right. Even those of you who have been in the industry for a long time, I think will be surprised that the United States relies on China for about 78% of total vitamins that are being produced, and a lot of precursors. So one could argue more than 78%. And what we really found with this is that happened very quickly with some concerted investment that China's been making in vitamin production. So it's really not about pricing. It's really about, can I get this product at all, as you've already mentioned. And so what we're also concerned about is we see the same thing happening with amino acids. We're seeing it begin to happen with critical minerals. So our concern is, let's not repeat this concentration that's happened on vitamins in other critical sectors as well, critical ingredients. So absolutely, it's something that I think people will be very surprised about. And to help people understand, what does it mean for an animal when you can't get vitamin D3, which, by the way, is completely supplemented. Animals don't really get D3 naturally or through other ration ingredients. What happens to production? And it's quite shocking what it does for rate of gain, days to market, animal mortality. It's quite stunning. And I think folks will enjoy the 12-page summary, not the full report, as you mentioned. And we also have some species-specific reports. If you just want to find out what's it mean for beef cattle, as an example, you can look at just the beef report.
And as you mentioned, to my understanding, the Securing American Agriculture Act, like the idea here is to create legislation that makes it a requirement that we go and look at it, right? And then a follow-up step would be okay, once this is done, and if what we expect to happens and it says, okay, no, we now have a national understanding that this is a problem, that there would likely be follow-up legislation or government investments and things like that into, okay, companies that might want to reshore some of that production or figure out how to do that through all the normal various things of, you know, tax incentives to build plants and all that. But that's not a part of this. That's down the road after we get everybody understand there's a problem, right?
Yes, you're 100% right. And this is a lot of legislation, when it gets passed, it solves the problem, right? It takes care of the issue. This is certainly not the case. This is this problem developed over the long term, and it's going to take a long-term solution to address it. So we're also talking to the administration and working extensively with them. This would be a great signal from Congress that this issue was of a big concern to them as well. If this when this legislation passes, that will be a clear signal. We've also been fortunate to have a lot of supporters in Congress send a letter to the White House expressing concerns about this over-reliance and to the point of almost exclusive reliance on some vitamins and products. So we are working to really look at, what are all of the things that have to happen for us to be able to onshore production of vitamins? And even more urgently, how do we protect the amino acid production we have here from unfair price competition and predatory practices?
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Well, like you said before, everybody has to eat, and that usually helps us, you know, get our message across at some point. Sometimes it takes the effort, but hopefully get everybody's attention. All right. One more to go. The last one is I've only read it, so I don't know how people like to say it, MARA or MARA Act, you can tell me. So the question is, what is that act, MARA, for those that are wondering why I can't decide which way it's supposed to be said. What is it and how is it relevant to our industry?
Well, Adam, I don't know if this is the correct way to say it, but I say MARA. So
okay. Good. We're on the same page. That's what I think too.
Absolutely. MARA is the Marine Aquaculture Research for America Act. It's HR 5746, for those of you who like numbers, and Senate 2586. And it lays the groundwork for a science-based approach to developing sustainable offshore aquaculture in U.S. federal waters that we're hoping will eventually lead to domestic production of seafood. I don't know about you, I love seafood. I am a big fan of some of that healthy seafood protein. I really like a good shrimp cocktail once in a while. But we really do import most of our seafood. The seafood we consume, we import most of that here in the United States. What this bill does is it authorizes the Office of Aquaculture within the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, and it establishes commercial scale demonstration projects. So when you think about how the United States approaches its federal waters management, we are very excited about being able to source more from the U.S. It not only increases our resilience, which we've talked about in another field, and create economic opportunity, which is wonderful. But we also are very keen on responsible fishing off of our shores. And not every country focuses so much attention on responsibly harvesting wild catch seafood. So that's one of the reasons we're very excited about this. And we are really supporting this legislation along with a lot of other folks who are interested, environmental groups, the U.S. aquaculture industry. We all agree that we're missing out on an opportunity and need to be supporting the growth of the U.S. industry.
Yeah. And one of the nice things here is kind of in some ways similar to the what we talked about with the Innovative Feed Act. It's not as if, okay, we would like to, you know, see some legislation to make this something that is more feasible, and then we'll actually go figure out how to do it. There's lots of places around the world that do this. We know how to do it, and we can certainly go learn from them how to do it. We do have places that have the right waters, right? We've got good subtropical waters that we can grow in. You know, we obviously do farming already of things like Atlantic salmon and things like that. We certainly do, freshwater farming on land. So between what we know and what we can go learn, it's not a huge amount of, you know, develop from scratch the ability to do this. Now, infrastructure will have to be developed, no doubt about that. That's a huge part of it.
But absolutely. But the
how on earth do we even do this? That's pretty well established. So that helps. I think I would think kind of drive this legislation of this isn't pie in the sky. It's not that. It's bringing the creating the framework under which we can do things that we know can be done.
Correct. And while it establishes a demonstration project, to your point, it's not necessarily how do you go and catch fish, right? It's more about how do you do it responsibly? What tools are out there that already exist? But it also directs NOAA to permit offshore aquaculture. So it gives a license to operate, most Yeah. importantly. And so it is going to create some of those opportunities for the domestic aquaculture industry to grow and help offset some of the trade deficit that we have right now in aquaculture. We're interested in it. Obviously, we have a lot of aquaculture feed manufacturers out there that are very interested in seeing this as well. So once you start having more U.S. supply of wild caught, it also helps stimulate demand for domestically produced farmed aquaculture as well. There's a synergy there that happens. Yep. The other thing I would definitely say again, and I want to say this as many times as I can to members of the U.S. food and agricultural system, is not to be afraid of the word sustainably harvesting or sustainably producing, because we do it better than anybody else in the world. We've been doing it. We've called it conservation, right, Adam? And so I truly believe that if we have more U.S. Harvested and farmed aquaculture, it's more sustainable and better for the rest of the world, because we do put a lot of controls in place. We know what percentage of the fish population we can harvest without affecting the overall health of those species. So it's a very exciting opportunity to be able to tap into that, bring some of those dollars back home, and provide a resiliency in our demand for aquaculture.
Most companies know AI can help, but the hard part is getting it deployed inside the business. Elevate Agents builds and launches custom AI agents that handle repetitive workflows, reduce manual overhead, and help teams move faster without adding headcount. From identifying the right use cases to deploying agents that actually work in your operations, Elevate turns AI from an idea into execution. Build smarter systems with Elevate Agents. Visit elevateagents.ai.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is too, and you know, I'm part of a poultry science department here at NC State. And so we get to be king of all food animal production. And so I can say things that are good about other potential species without having to be too worried about us getting taken over. Right. But you know, it's funny, people will still think, I don't know, you know, farmed aquaculture, and I'm in the grocery store and I think I'm going to buy that wild caught fillet versus the farm, right? But very, very few people, and great, if it's your thing, no problem, that's fine, but not that many people are actually going to the local butcher to get their chicken breast or their hamburger thing. Like, we are, and have been for centuries, we are going to get our food from the farm, right? We've moved over the last two centuries. We have moved slowly and then very rapidly since 1950 into the idea that most people aren't going to grow their own food and things like that that come from farm. And this is no different. It's just that mindset's got to shift a little there, because it's not something we're used to. But the other thing that, you know, is from the really cool thing about the aquaculture side is that it's healthy, right? And as many of our animal products are, but as you mentioned, a lot of our fish species are very healthy, and you can have healthy diets eating them. And from a sustainability standpoint, nothing touches their feed conversion, because they get to float around and not walk. And so when you can have an animal that approaches a 1-to-1 feed conversion, and we're looking at everything else that we have to feed, and again, I'm not knocking it, look where I work kind of a thing, but everything else, you know, we do have to put more input than what we get out of the animal. Fish get really close to what goes in gets to come out. And that's a huge deal from a, not only a sustainability standpoint, but when it's that plus health, plus the fact that a lot of people like to eat fish, it makes a huge amount of sense for us to try to grow that part of food animal production.
It is spot on. You know, my attitude has always been, when I want a steak or bacon or a chicken breast, I am going to go get a steak or bacon or chicken, right? And when I want fish, I'm going to go get fish. These are always not, this is just satisfying a need for variety, for balanced diet, for a varied diet. And it also, when you think about it, the world needs more animal protein. Because it's not just a protein, there's all the micronutrients that come with that. We need more. So when I think about it, it's not one, if demand for one product goes up, we don't necessarily see a decline in demand for other products. So it's not about changing the piece size of the piece of pie you get. It's about growing the pie. And these are efficient little critters, as you have said. It is amazing how they can convert feed to food that we want to eat. And so it is, I think it's an exciting opportunity for the United States. I think it's an exciting opportunity for consumers. I'm a big fan of farmed fish. I'm a scuba diver. And so, you know, I get out there and I see what's in the ocean and that kind of thing. And I kind of like the idea of selecting farm raised fish for my consumption. So it is I think it's a really exciting opportunity. I think this is an enabling piece of legislation that will allow us to expand that and expand it responsibly. More responsibly maybe than many other parts of the world where we're currently sourcing product. So that's the excitement about this piece of legislation. We're going to be really pushing for it to be integrated into other omnibus bills that may be passing. And we are excited about the opportunities it presents.
Absolutely. I'll share my favorite. We, you know, I haven't gotten to get too exposed to a huge amount of aquaculture feed production. We've done some here. We've got a pretty decent industry here in North Carolina on things like tilapia hybrid striped bass and things like that. But actually, my favorite story about it comes from when I was a graduate student at Kansas State, and we were making feed for somebody, and they were we were making research feed for a shrimp producer, and they were going to feed all these shrimp. And they brought the thing that we were testing, they brought was a liquid that we had to spray onto the feed. And it was some sort of I don't know if it was krill specifically. It was awfully pink, so it might have been, but it was like a slurry made from kind of these like, you know, micro protein, micro animal, whatever, you know, to feed the shrimp, because obviously that's what the shrimp eat. And we were making the feed, and at some point, you know, I think as it was coming through the pump, it was a relatively small amount. And I said, you know, I'm not positive it's all getting on. How careful do we need to be to make sure the inclusion is perfect? And he said, I've overformulated by about 20% or so, just to be sure. I'm like, okay, perfect. Yeah, we're definitely getting more than 80% on. I said, out of curiosity, like this, how much, and we were making 1,000 pounds of feed in that particular mixer. And I said, how much is this little jar worth that we're putting into this? And the number was something astronomical. It's like $5,000 or something for this like little 1 liter thing. And I was like, granted it's experimental, so it's going to get cheaper. And I'm thinking to myself, there's no way. How does this work? And that's when he reminded me. He's like, you're making 1,000 pounds of feed. I want you to go to the grocery store and I want you to price out 1,000 pounds of raw, like in the deli or in the fish case, not frozen over here, but in the fish case. I want you to price out 1,000 pounds of that and come back and tell me how much those shrimp are selling for. And I went, ah, okay. Yeah. The feed can be pretty darned expensive when they're converting it 1-to-1 and, or pretty close to it. And you can sell fish for that much. I'm like, okay, this is a little different world than least cost formulation for the poultry industry or the swine industry. So.
Absolutely. That's a great experience to have had.
Yeah. That was my kind of wake up moment. Like, oh yeah, this is a different world. So
yes, it
very
is. Good.
Well, I very much enjoyed our conversation. Thanks for joining us. And on behalf of those of us on the education side and in the industry, we certainly appreciate all of AFIA's work. I know you guys spend huge amounts of time, you know, putting together these resources and going up to the Hill and talking to people and, you know, to some extent, obviously, lobbying is a part of it. But I think the educating part of what you guys do is so huge, because you know, of all the people up in Congress and sitting in the Senate and sitting in the House, while we've seen a lot of support for our industry, there's not going to be a whole lot of people that are intimately familiar with what we do. So we appreciate all the education you guys do on behalf of us so that they understand better. Because I think once they understand, like we've talked already, it's not hard for them to support what we do.
Thank you, Adam. And I have to say that we're really fortunate in the animal food industry to have an amazing membership base that really believes in what we're doing. And when you've got 50 industry leaders going up and doing 63 hill visits to help you educate the staff and the members of Congress on what we're about, you feel pretty humbled by that. And so I'll accept your thank you, but I have to share that with our industry leaders that just really knock it out of the park for us when it comes to helping the public and helping policymakers understand why this sector is so important to the industry.
Well, it's been a great conversation. Again, my guest has been Constance Coleman. Constance is the president and CEO of the American Feed Industry Association and the president of iFeeder, the Institute for Feed Education and Research. Thank you, Constance.
Thank you so much. And thanks for putting up with my songbirds.
Absolutely. On behalf of Wisenetics and North Carolina State University, the Animal Feeding and Management Program here, thanks for joining us, and we will talk to you the next time.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.